We're here for argument in the case of Cash Advance versus the State of Colorado, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Conley Schulte, and I'm here on behalf of the petitioners, the Miami Nation Enterprises, a subdivision of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, and SFS Inc., a wholly owned and chartered corporation of the Santee Sioux Nation. For purposes of convenience today, I'll refer to the petitioners collectively as the tribal entities. Before I begin, I'd like to advise the court that my co-counsel, Ed Lyons, from the law firm of Jones and Keller, could not be here today due to an unexpected illness that has required him to be in the hospital. So at counsel table is Mr. Tom Burke, his partner from Jones and Keller, and my partner, Shelley Muller. We presented four issues for review here today. First of all, did the Court of Appeals err in holding that tribal sovereign immunity does not apply to state subpoena enforcement proceedings? Second, did the Court of Appeals err in creating an 11-part test to determine whether the tribal entities may assert tribal sovereign immunity? Third, did the Court of Appeals err in holding that tribal officials who are alleged to violate state law lose the protections of tribal sovereign immunity? And fourth, did the Court of Appeals err in finding that the tribal entities may have waived their immunity to these proceedings by agreeing to arbitrate disputes with their consumers? I'd like to focus my arguments today on the first two issues for review. And we believe that the Court of Appeals erred in holding that tribal sovereign immunity does not apply to state subpoena enforcement proceedings for a number of reasons, but primarily because it is contrary to the United States Supreme Court's decision in Kiowa Tribe of Oklahoma versus Manufacturing Technologies. In Kiowa Tribe, the Supreme Court held that as a matter of federal law, Indian tribes are subject to suit only when authorized by Congress or when the tribe has waived its sovereign immunity. The court further held that even where state laws apply to off-reservation activity, a state may not bring suit to enforce a state law against an Indian tribe absent a waiver of that immunity or abrogation by Congress. To quote the Supreme Court from the Kiowa decision, there is a difference between the right to demand compliance with state law and the means available to enforce them.
Counsel, can I stop you there? I mean, that's obviously the line you're asking us to draw, is the distinction between sort of investigation and actually some sort of litigation, or and can you help me draw that line? I mean, where do you think that line should be drawn in this, on the facts of this case?
Well, on the facts of this case, when the state of Colorado invokes the jurisdiction of the district court to enforce a subpoena, that is a judicial action that we submit the tribes are protected from that judicial action by tribal sovereign immunity.
So is the line drawn whenever a party asks the court for help? Is that basically where you want the line drawn?
For purposes of this case, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Could you, Mr. Schulte, just tell us a little bit about what information you have given? Summarize that. It was not clear to me already to the trial court before the enforcement began.
Certainly, Your Honor. And it's important to note that there has never been an evidentiary hearing in this matter before the trial court. But we did provide the state with nearly 4,000 pages worth of information.
I understand you gave them a lot of paper, but what did the paper say?
The papers consisted of, number one, the organic laws of the tribes that established these organizations. For the Santee Sioux Tribe, there was the tribe's business corporations code, which contains a special section for wholly owned tribal corporations that designates them as being entitled to assert the tribe's sovereign immunity, among other things. We also provided the organic formation documents for SFS Inc., including the tribal resolutions creating the entity and the articles of incorporation and bylaws, which established that the entity is, SFS Inc., is wholly owned by the Santee Sioux Nation, 100% owned. Its board of directors mirrors the tribal council of the Santee Sioux Nation, which is the governing body of the tribe pursuant to its constitution, which was approved by the Secretary of the Interior. And we also provided, and those documents rather also provide that the The corporation is entitled to all the privileges and immunities of the tribe, including the right of sovereignty.
What was the connection between that and the Nevada?
Your Honor, we submit that there is no connection other than the fact that
the trademark,
the Nevada corporations used the same unregistered trade names that at some point in time, apparently prior to the time the tribes began using those trade names.
Are they different entities? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they're completely different entities.
Unregistered trade name?
Yes, Your Honor. The trade names were not registered, and quite frankly, the name, for example, Cash Advance is very common in this industry. We checked the yellow pages for the state of Colorado before the Court of Appeals argument and found literally dozens of entities doing business in the state of Colorado using the name Cash Advance or some version of the term Cash Advance. So these trade names are rather ubiquitous in the industry.
Why did it take you so long to enter some sort of objection?
Your Honor, we made an appearance as soon as the tribal entities received notice. And the first notice that the tribal entities received of these proceedings was the motion for contempt. And these tribes were never officially served with the subpoenas or even the contempt action. But the tribes did receive actual notice of it. And as soon as we received notice, we appeared and moved to dismiss based upon lack of sufficient service and lack of jurisdiction due to tribal sovereign immunity.
The other tribe now, is it a wholly owned subsidiary mirroring the same directorship being a tribal council?
The Miami Nation Enterprises, or MNE, is formed as a political subdivision of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma pursuant to a tribal law called the MNE Act. That act establishes MNE as a political subdivision. Its board of directors is appointed by the chief of the tribe with the consent of the Tribal Business Committee, which is the governing body for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma pursuant to its constitution, which is also approved by the Secretary of the Interior. The board of directors are required by the MNE Act to be tribal members of the Miami Tribe, and it is also specifically endowed with the sovereign immunity of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma pursuant to its articles of organization.
So, now, is there any federal action available to enforce the state laws? I mean, this is off-reservation financial activity affecting the citizens of Colorado, right? I mean, you'd agree with that.
I do not dispute that, and in fact, the tribal entities comply with all applicable federal laws, and there are a number of federal laws that do apply to these activities. For example, the Truth in Lending Act, the Patriot Act, the Bank Secrecy Act, there are three that I'm aware of, and the applicable regulations that go with that. And the notion that the state has asserted that this is somehow unregulated activity simply is not true. In addition to those federal laws, each one of these tribes has enacted a comprehensive regulatory scheme to regulate these activities, and I submit that it would rival that of any state in this country in terms of regulating payday lending. And the tribes themselves have issued licenses to these tribal entities and actively regulate them. So the notion, Your Honor, that this is unregulated is not true. Now, to the extent that the state would like more regulation in this area, it does have the ability to petition Congress for more regulations, and there are instances where states have.
But what you're asserting is that there's no form for Colorado to assert its Consumer Protection Act authority, among other acts.
According to the United States Supreme Court's decision in Kiowa Tribe of Oklahoma, state regulatory laws may apply to off-reservation tribal activity. It's just that the state cannot bring a judicial action to enforce them against the tribes.
Either in state or federal court under your position?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. Tribal sovereign immunity applies in both state and federal court.
And that would be entirely different if it were an individual, right? In non-Indian country, off the reservation, right?
Generally, individual tribal members are not protected by the tribe's sovereign immunity. Individuals that are acting in their official capacities are.
So both of these persons, as heads of the people that are held in contempt, as heads of the, are arms of the tribe, essentially, is that, that's what your argument is, right?
Yes, I mean, both of these tribal entities are owned and controlled by officials that are members of the tribe. The board of directors are required to be tribal members. And in fact, in the case of SFS Inc., the board of directors mirrors the tribal council of the tribe.
Could I interrupt one second? In answering that, you said, but how did you say it? Individuals or officers acting in their official capacity are immune. Why is that?
Your Honor, it is effectively no different than a state or federal official who's acting in their official capacities generally enjoy the sovereign immunity of the sovereign.
Has that connection or comparison between the two kinds of sovereign immunity ever been made by the U.S. Supreme Court?
I'm not aware that there's been a direct comparison by the United States Supreme Court, but I am aware, for example, that the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals has held that tribal sovereign immunity is coextensive with that of the United States. And that holding was in the Minor Electric versus Muscogee Creek Nation case that we've cited and discussed in our briefs.
Could I ask you, and I'm not trying to pin you down to particular words, but just because I don't usually deal in these cases, maybe you could explain to me. In one of the cases that's cited by both of you here, Oklahoma Tax Commission versus Citizen Band Potawatomi Indian Tribe, 1991, the majority has a sentence at about 514, where they say, we have never held that individual agents or officers of a tribe are not liable for the damages and actions brought by the state. Could you explain that to me and how that fits in with what you're just saying?
Well, Your Honor, that sentence there, that part of the decision is dicta in that case. And it's not a holding that states that tribal officials who are acting contrary to state law may be not protected by their tribe's immunity. It's merely an observation that the court has never addressed that issue. And if that passage also talks about actions against tribal officials for damages, but that's not the situation here. Tribal officials have never been named defendants in this case, nor served with any of the documents, nor is this an action for damages.
And so as far as the United States Supreme Court jurisprudence goes, you would concede that's an undecided point?
That is correct, Your Honor. That the court has never held that tribal officials acting contrary to state law or lose their sovereign immunity. And it's interesting that the Supreme Court there cited the Ex parte Young decision for that proposition, but Ex parte Young applies only to asserted violations of federal law, not state law or tribal law.
I guess part of my question here is drawing the connection or deciding the scope of sovereign immunity as it applies to the tribes here. And this, along with a number of other passages, seem to suggest that this immunity is sui generis in some way. And it may share some things in common with sovereign immunity amongst states, or state sovereign immunity, but is not coextensive with it. Is that an unreasonable observation on my part?
I don't believe that's an unreasonable observation, although there have been observations by many courts that tribal sovereign immunity, in fact, may be even broader than that of the states, because the tribes, for example, were not parties to the Constitutional Convention, where states gave up certain rights in the Constitution to become part of the Union, and tribes did not do so. So in some respects, their sovereignty and sovereign immunity is greater than that.
And especially with regard to business enterprise, that may be true. But is that something of a concession or agreement that the two are not the same in any event?
That is correct, Your Honor. There are definitely distinctions between state sovereign immunity and tribal sovereign immunity. We've discussed those in our briefs. Turning back to the Kiowa tribe decision, because I think the Kiowa tribe of Oklahoma case really is outcome determinative of the issues in this case. There, the court held that tribal sovereign immunity is subject to diminution only by Congress and not by the states. And the district, or rather the Court of Appeals in this matter, by carving out a certain type of judicial proceedings, subpoena enforcement proceedings, that are not subject to tribal sovereign immunity effectively diminished tribal sovereign immunity at the hands of the state, and according to the Kiowa tribe decision, that is not permissible. And I'd like to point out that none of the authorities relied upon by the Court of Appeals or the state changed the outcome of the Kiowa. Kiowa tribe controls. The authorities relied upon by the state deal with, either do not deal with sovereign immunity, or they deal with actions by the federal government to enforce federal law against tribal officials. Well, it's fundamental that, like state officials, tribal officials are subject to federal law under the theory that the federal government is a superior sovereign. So those authorities do not apply here. And the one authority that did involve a state action against an Indian tribe that relied upon by the state is the Narragansett case. But in that case, there was a specific federal statute that applied federal law to the Narragansett tribe, and gave the state's authority under federal law to bring that action. There is no similar federal statute here.
It would seem that the Court of Appeals was trying to articulate a number of factors that would identify whether or not this was a true tribal entity controlled by the tribal government. Isn't that right? I mean, it would be on the threshold inquiry into jurisdiction, is what I'm trying to say, that they were attempting to determine whether these were bona fide tribal entities. Do you agree with that view of what the Court of Appeals was trying to do or not?
Well, I agree that you need to determine whether the tribal entities are owned and controlled by the tribes and are formed under tribal law. But we disagree with the 11-part test that the Court of Appeals created. That test was copied from a dissenting opinion in the Wright v. Colville Tribal Enterprises case out of the state of Washington, while ignoring the majority holding that case. But there are several problems with that 11-part test, and primarily some of the factors in that test were expressly rejected by the United States Supreme Court in the Kiowa case. For example, in the Supreme Court's decision in the Kiowa case, the Supreme Court rejected the invitation to distinguish between the purpose of the tribal activity or the purpose of the tribal entity, whether it's governmental or commercial. The court was also invited to make exceptions to tribal sovereign immunity depending upon the location where it occurred, on or off reservation. At least one factor in this 11-part test seems to limit tribal activities to on-reservation, tribal sovereign immunity, rather, to on-reservation activities. And beyond that, the very purpose of this 11-part test is really to create limits on tribal sovereign immunity, and that is something that the Supreme Court in Kiowa made clear that is not something that the state has the power to do, but rather Congress has the authority and really is the correct body to weigh the competing policies and concerns that would be involved in creating limits on tribal sovereign immunity or formulating a test for determining which type of tribal activities or which type of tribal institutions may or may not be entitled to sovereign immunity. In fact, the Supreme Court itself went on at some length in that decision to discuss the various tribal entities and enterprises that tribes are currently engaged in that have become sort of far removed from what we would consider traditional governmental functions. The Supreme Court discussed ski resorts, casinos, the sale of tobacco, for example, and noted that it was invited to make distinctions between these activities, but decided that the appropriate body to make those distinctions would be Congress. And at the current, as we stand here today, Congress has not taken any action to make distinctions. Although, and the court did point out in Kiowa, Congress has acknowledged the existence of tribal sovereign immunity by statute, and in some instances, narrow instances, has created limits. In the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, for example, there is some limitation on tribal sovereign immunity for resolving disputes with states. So Congress knows how to create limits on tribal sovereign immunity, but Congress has chosen not to do so in this area. And I submit that, as the United States Supreme Court held, Congress is the appropriate body to do so, and I submit that this court ought to follow suit.
Mr. Shelton, I wonder, I noticed in the briefs you distinguish, I understand, Nevada versus Hicks, but there's a statement in it And it's a more recent case in Kiowa, which I guess I'd like you to tell me how we should think about this. Nothing in the federal statutory scheme prescribes or even remotely suggests that state officers cannot enter a reservation to investigate or prosecute violations of state law occurring off the reservation. To the contrary, 25 U.S.C. 2806 affirms that the provisions of this chapter alter neither the law enforcement, investigative, or judicial authority of any state, etc. So how are we to view that statement? I understand the argument that it's dicta and that this was directed at a slightly different factual pattern, but what does that mean for us?
That entire discussion was made with the background of that case, and that involved an individual tribal member,
right,
who was accused of violating various laws regarding hunting. And we don't dispute that individual tribal members are subject and can be subject to state law. And that discussion really was focused on the state's ability to enter a reservation to enforce state laws against individual Indians. There was no part of the discussion at all that was focused on the tribe as a tribe, which enjoys sovereign immunity.
Well, in your view, how should the state have proceeded? Because as I understand the facts, when it began this investigation, had no knowledge that these entities had any connection with tribes. What, from your point of view, what should it have done? Gets complaints against companies A and B. What does it do?
Well, Your Honor, once the state discovered that the tribal entities were involved here, the state has the option of engaging in government-to-government negotiations with tribes, and states have entered into agreements with tribes on a number of issues, ranging, you know, from gaming to water rights to police powers to state taxation and other areas. And there are really no limits to agreements between tribes and states on any subject matter, and this one, I submit, is ripe for that as well.
But as I understand it, the way this case started out, there was no claim, there was no response from the lending companies. What was the state supposed to do at that point?
Well, I do not have any disagreement that this, and part of the problem was the state brought these proceedings in the name of the trade names, not really any entities. So there was confusion there from the beginning. I don't disagree with the way in which the state proceeded up to the point that it was aware that it was dealing with Indian tribes.
Let's talk about that point, awareness that they are dealing with Indian tribes. I mean, how should the state go about, in your view, determining the whatever remains of the 11-part test, I guess, in your view, ownership, control, and formation? And specifically, is there a problem with requiring the tribes to demonstrate ownership, control, and formation in order to assert immunity with respect to the particular entities who are endowed, at least by the state, as to what their relationship is with the tribe?
Your Honor, we have submitted that the correct test, if you want to call it, for determining whether these are tribal entities would be one simply ask whether the tribal entities were created under tribal law and are owned and controlled by the tribe. That is similar to the test that the majority held in the Wright v. Colville decision. With regard to the burden of proof, tribal sovereign immunity, like sovereign immunity of the United States, is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, and therefore the burden of proof is on the plaintiff. And that is well established. In fact, the Tenth Circuit has made no mistake that sovereign immunity is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
I understand that your claim is that you're immune from suit, of course, and that would include discovery or any kind of enforcement in the courts, because that would be a suit. That is your position, right?
That is correct.
The problem is, and we see this in every kind of immunity case, the Trinity series federal immunity cases, is that tension of deciding both what, in a court setting, what's consistent with a lack of subject matter jurisdiction and allowing enough discovery so you can determine whether there is insufficient subject matter jurisdiction. You would agree with that. I mean, that's always a real tension.
Yeah,
isn't that what the Court of Appeals was trying to do, is to set forth a way to get some kind of discovery, sort of in a Trinity-like way, to analogize to the state procedure, so we could determine whether there's subject matter jurisdiction? You can't just say, to put it differently, there is a lack of discovery, there is a lack of subject matter jurisdiction here, we're immune from suit, you can't even take us to court. And that's, if I understand that, that is in fact your position, isn't it?
Your Honor, we don't dispute that we have the burden of going forward to establish that these are tribally owned entities. And in fact, we've provided the state with thousands of pages of documents to establish that.
Let's take it just one step forward. And so then, therefore, does it follow that you wouldn't dispute that a hearing is appropriate to test that information? Because I heard you answer Justice Ide something different.
We don't dispute that a limited type of hearing to determine the limited issue of whether the tribal entities are created under tribal law and are owned and controlled by the tribe business.
And isn't that more or less what the Court of Appeals ordered, is a remand to have that limited hearing?
And we don't dispute that is something that may be required in this case, but the test itself is what we have an issue with. And
so specifically the test itself that what is it that you want the trial judge to do? That's where I'm confused about your position. You don't like those 11 tests, but really it's just a logical sort of way of looking at the issue, whether we call it 11 tests or not. What is it that you want to happen at this limited hearing?
Well, we would ask the court to remand to the district court to make a determination whether these entities are created under tribal law and are owned and controlled by the tribes. And
but that's consistent with the Court of Appeals.
Well, the Court of Appeals 11-part test went beyond that, and in fact, it went far beyond what the state of Colorado requires even to show that its own entities are arms of the state. There's a simple 3-part test that the state uses to determine whether arms of the state are protected by state immunity, and we submit that there's a bit of a double standard here because the Court of Appeals test goes far beyond that.
But at least we could say that one way or another, the district court has to decide whether or not there is sovereign immunity.
That
and
correct.
However he or she does it, he has to make that decision. Is that right?
I would say that is correct.
So we're kind of quibbling over 3 tests, 11 tests.
That is the issue, is how do you make that determination?
Okay. And so what exactly is your position as to how that decision ought to be made?
You know, we would ask that the test simply be whether these tribal entities are created under tribal law and they're owned and controlled by the tribes, and whether there's been any waiver of immunity.
What was that? I'm sorry, the third?
Whether there has been any waiver of immunity.
What about the issue of some discovery to allow the state to be able to meet its burden if, in fact, we agreed with you?
We don't dispute that limited discovery directed solely to those issues is permitted. And in fact, we conceded that in the district court, which is why we provided 4,000 pages worth of documents to the state. And I respectfully see I only have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm a senior assistant attorney, Paul Chesson, on behalf of the respondents, cross petitioners, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I want to start by saying that what is involved here is an investigation. And to paraphrase from the United States Supreme Court case in Morgan Salt, simply the state seeks information about an illegal payday lending enterprise from those who have the information, and yet who are most interested in not providing it. And I think it is important to recount how we got to where we are today. The state, back beginning in 2003 and in 2004, received information that two lenders one going by the name of cash advance and the other going by the name of preferred cash loans. We're making illegal payday loans in Colorado to Colorado consumers. The state's and the information that the state had at that time was that these two lenders were located and were used addresses in Carson City, Nevada. The state served investigative subpoenas upon these two lenders in Carson City, Nevada. The lenders ignored the subpoena, so the state obtained court orders enforcing these subpoenas. The state then served these orders upon the lenders again at their addresses in Carson City, Nevada. The lenders ignored these court orders, so the state went back to court and got and obtained contempt citations. It then served these contempt citations again upon these lenders at their addresses in Carson City, Nevada. 2 days before the contempt advisement hearings, the return date on the contempt citations, petitioners appeared suddenly. They appeared, they jumped in this case. They said, we are the lenders. The lenders are us. The lenders are our trade names. We are subdivisions of Indian tribes, and we are entitled to tribal immunity, and therefore you, the state, cannot use the courts to enforce your investigation. As Mr. Schulte said, he concedes that his clients received actual notice of the contempt citations. Yet he also says...
Well, those aren't directed against the tribe, right?
No, they were not. We did, the state at the time did not even know about any tribal involvement in this act.
So are we up here on a contempt citation at all, or?
I'm sorry.
What's the setting? What are we trying to do here? I mean, are you trying to enforce the contempt citation?
Yes, ultimately, yes, we are.
Against whom? It was issued against independent corporations.
Our investigation needs to proceed because are we dealing with two independent sets of lenders, Carson City, Nevada lenders, who Mr. Schulte's clients say they have absolutely no relationship with. And if that is the case, then how did Mr. Schulte's clients find out about this case? Why did they jump in and insinuate themselves into this case? And if there is no relationship, then it appears that maybe they're just simply interlopers with no standing before this court. Because our investigation, the lending activity that precipitated the state's investigation appeared to be being conducted by Nevada corporations using a Carson City, Nevada address.
Mr. Justin, can I ask you a factual question? I may be wrong, but I seem to remember that there was an individual who is not connected with tribes who is a subject of contempt from Nevada. Is that incorrect?
That's yes, Mr. James Fontana.
Right, and what happened there?
The information that we had, he at the time appeared to be the president of the Nevada corporations using these Carson City, Nevada addresses that also were, and the lenders were trade names of these Nevada corporations. This is not in the record, but subsequently state entered into a consent decree with Mr. Fontana, and he resolved the contempt against him.
Was there any discovery conducted with respect to him?
Yes, there was.
As to the relationship to the tribes?
Yes, there was. And again, that's not in the record, Your Honor.
Well, if it was a subterfuge, I mean, it seems to me the argument you're making is that this is a subterfuge, that these guys in Nevada went up and hired the Indian reservations, and therefore, you know, they can claim sovereign immunity to continue committing their crimes. I mean, that's the underlying thesis, I think, of what your position is.
There are certainly inconsistencies in the record, whether or not it is a subterfuge, we think the state's, and that's why the state's investigation, we think, needs to run its course.
Well, in the documents that have been provided you, the 4,000 pages of documents, is there any indication that this is a not accurate?
Let's look at those 3,000 or 4,000 pages of documents. Of course, those 3,000 or 4,000 pages of documents are not in the record. What is in the record is a description of those documents. At page 862 of the record, the state described it. Several hundred pages, hundreds of pages of those documents consist of irrelevancies, things like tribal cemetery rules and regulations, things like procurement policies, how do they procure supplies from various vendors, child welfare matters, and other things. The documents that they did produce to the court are their tribal corporations, things like the tribal corporation's organizational documents, their tribal payday loan ordinances, a few applications for tribal payday licenses.
Well, is there anything indicating that cash advance and preferred cash loans are trade names of a tribal?
Other than these licenses, but
the date that occurred?
I was going to get to the date because all of the documents post-date the lending activity that precipitated the state's investigation.
And post-date?
SFS Inc. was not created until March of 2005. MNE Inc. was not created until May of 2005. And the state's investigation had to do with lending activity that began in 2003 and 2004. And critically, among the documents that they did not produce and refused to produce, despite court orders compelling them to produce, were documents that related to, for example, their revenues. Where did the revenues go? How do these lending businesses account for and distribute their revenues?
Mr. Chesson?
Yes.
I understand that there's a lot of discovery that you did not obtain which relate to parts of the Court of Appeals 11-part test. But I guess what I'm trying to understand is whether the discovery that you did is adequate with respect to the three issues that are argued by the tribes, which should be a part of any test, which is just the ownership, control, and formation. And so, therefore, is the dispute here about discovery that relates to parts of the test that the two sides here disagree as to whether they should be included? Or is the discovery dispute broader than that?
I think it's broader than that, although even as to the three tests that they desire, it's one thing to say, for example, that SFS Inc. Is a tribal corporation organized under tribal law and wholly owned by the tribe. It is quite a different thing to say, is SFS Inc. doing the actual lending? Is it accepting the loan applications?
Now, I understand that from a sort of a consumer protection standpoint in terms of how that was argued. But if we accept the three-part test, if we accept that the inquiry is limited, as has been argued here, then why does that matter? How does that relate to ownership, control, and formation? It seems that it relates to something beyond that. Now, I can see clearly that it relates to the 11-part test of the Court of Appeals if we adopt that, but I'm having trouble seeing why that relates to ownership, control, and formation.
Well, I think that test proves too much, and let me throw out this hypothetical. Let us assume that the tribal companies have formed their companies, but they have, for example, may have delegated complete control of the payday lending operations to non-tribal business. And let's say that the payday lending enterprise takes in $1 million of revenue per month. And of that $1 million of revenue, 1% of it goes to the tribal corporation, and 99% of it goes to the non-tribal entities. And the non-tribal entities conduct 100% of the operation. They underwrite the loans, they approve the loans, they collect the loans, and they bear the risk of loss of the loans. Is it simply enough to say, SFS Inc. is organized under tribal law and is wholly owned by the tribes, even though the payday lending enterprise
Let me just sort of restate your hypothetical and ask you the same question, and that is, what I hear you saying is, if the tribes wholly own an entity, and they hire someone out to totally operate it for 99% of revenue, is that, do they lose their immunity as a result of that?
Certainly the Supreme Court hasn't answered that question. The state's position would be yes, they have lost their immunity.
And at what point?
I'm sorry?
And so how would you determine that? I mean, I think maybe your answer would be different if it's at 1% with the tribe getting 99%. So how do you test that?
Well, it is a case-by-case basis. It's an ad hoc approach. And these various factors are designed to look into that. I would think the overarching purpose of these factors, as said in the Gristides case, which was cited by Tribal Amici and which we cited in our reply brief, the overarching search is the enterprise, is it more than a mere business?
There would be a great deal of discretion involved in making that decision with such a broad test that includes that kind of examination of revenue and costs and revenue sharing. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
Well, just that is a rather discretionary test that a court would have to apply.
Well, again, it's certainly a fact-specific test. Yes, it's a fact-specific test. And the Court of Appeals certainly arrived at 11 factors. We would say that whether it's 11, whether it's something, you still need to look at this overarching, is it more than a mere business? And
is there any point at which that sort of crosses some line, I would think, between state control and decision-making about that question versus your opponents would argue, which is that's you're really talking about regulation for Congress.
Well,
so where's that? How do we balance that or find that dividing line?
Well, I think the courts in the various states and the lower federal courts have certainly tried to establish some lines, and they've come up with various factors. I don't know how to answer your question other than to say that it is a fact-specific inquiry, and it is a case-by-case. The kinds of, and perhaps I can illustrate with the types of the arm of the tribe entities that have been found to have been arms of the tribe out of some of the federal cases. For example, a nonprofit on-reservation community college that provides education to tribal members. That has been found to have been an arm of the tribe and therefore able to cloak itself with the tribe's immunity. Another has been a health clinic, a nonprofit on-reservation health clinic to provide health services to the tribe, to the tribal members. That also has been found to be an arm of the tribe. Here we're dealing with off-reservation activities, ostensibly for profit, although we assume it's for profit. Haven't seen the actual numbers, but we...
Can I interrupt here if you're finished with this line of questions? Because I really am asking more or less the same thing as Justice Martinez. In my mind, I keep trying to distinguish and understand the procedural posture that we're finding this case in. And I understand that the reason where we've got to a contempt citation is because you feel you didn't get enough discovery to figure out what the hypothetical is or what the facts are in this particular case.
Well, actually, we didn't get any discovery. The entities to whom we served the subpoena enforcement orders ignored the orders. We didn't get any response.
Well, you got some documents, and you think they're insufficient.
Within the context of the contempt proceedings.
Okay. So the first thing that has to happen, I'm just trying to think forward, is if the case were to be remanded, there would have to be a decision about the extent of the discovery to be allowed. That hasn't been done yet, I gather, right?
No, what the Court of Appeals did was it said it provided a framework for the trial judge to reevaluate the state's discovery requests.
Right, and in and of itself, the whole issue of discovery is going to impact the question of immunity.
Yes, I think so.
So we're going to have to somehow derive, as the Court of Appeals did, or if we agree with your position, some sort of test to govern the extent of the immunity.
And yes, well, if...
The extent of the discovery, excuse me.
If you accept the framework that this is to be decided within the context of contempt, and
that's my ultimate question. We don't have any other procedural context.
Well, there is the Walling to Giacomo standards, and what is the appropriate scope of a subpoena enforcement proceeding? And should these kinds of factual issues be resolved in the context of a subpoena enforcement proceeding?
It would be cleaner and nicer if we weren't in the context of a contempt, but we are. Isn't that the only way this case is before us?
True, yes. We're in the context of contempt, and there is that fundamental question, that which was the first issue upon which we obtained argued in our briefs, is this whole scope of immunity, is that a proper inquiry in a subpoena enforcement proceeding? And we think it is not, for a number of reasons.
But it has to be, because you couldn't hold someone in contempt if there's immunity. It does get a little circular, but that's exactly the circle I want you to break up for me.
Okay, well, it does get, yes, it is circular. It is a chicken and an egg kind of a situation. But we believe that the U.S. Supreme Court has resolved that chicken and egg conundrum in the Walling cases, in the Endicott-Johnson cases, by saying we recognize that there's this circularity. And the way we resolve that circularity is you allow the investigation to run its course first, and then we can deal with the immunity questions later.
And what's happened here is that we don't have a nice, clean investigation running. Rather, what we have is a request to get the courts involved, which brings to the forefront this issue of immunity.
Well, that is immunity applicable to a subpoena enforcement proceeding?
Well, once you start using the court's power to put somebody in jail, I mean, then, in fact, you've really come to an immunity question pretty directly, haven't you? I mean, that's what I see as difficult about all of these prior cases, is they've had kind of a cleaner line between investigatory and enforcement, the courts. And here we're basically using the courts to try to enforce the lack of an investigation, the failure to give discovery, right?
Well, and certainly the U.S. Supreme Court has not provided much guidance in the context of an investigation or subpoena enforcement proceeding. Certainly in the Kiowa case, which involved a plenary lawsuit against for a promissory note and against a tribe. It was a contract action. But that it did not involve a subpoena enforcement.
So, Mr. Chesson, what do we do? I mean, I guess I'm thinking that none of the authorities are quite precisely on point.
That's correct. There is, although we believe that the Nevada v. Hicks case and the Inyo County case, to the extent there is any guidance, provide some guidance. And there's the quote that Justice Bender quoted from the Nevada v. Hicks case. Also, and this gets to Justice Ide's question at the outset of this argument. I think if you look at what is the fundamental purpose of sovereign immunity, and the purpose of sovereign immunity is to protect the sovereign's right of self-government, the right to make laws and be ruled by them. And in both the Nevada v. Hicks case and the Inyo County case, the Supreme Court said that, well, an investigation, a mere investigation, doesn't implicate that sovereignty concerns, doesn't affect the sovereign's right to make rules or be ruled by them. And so in an investigation context, there simply is no interference with the sovereign's sovereignty. And therefore, I would draw from that that, and again, looking for the guidance from Walling and Morgan Salt and Endicott v. Johnson, allow the investigation to proceed. And even if it means contempt, you will, because of a noncompliance with the investigation, allow that to run its course. And then, if and when there's a plenary lawsuit brought against a potentially immune party, at that point, the immunity issue can be raised and fully adjudicated. But to do so now is to put the cart before the horse.
It sounds like you're reinstituting the investigation in some ways. We apparently have a situation here where you're certainly interested in what's going on today, but the original reason for the investigation and the contempt citation may have to do with persons totally unconnected from the tribe. And
That's true. We are here simply trying to find out.
Yeah, well, maybe you need to recommence the investigation in a proper fashion. And then test whether or not the subpoenas can be issued against the tribe. But we're here apparently in the context of trying to enforce a contempt citation against someone who the court has never seen, that is apparently independent of the tribes. I mean, what are you trying to get someone before, in contempt, before the tribes actually form these enterprises, if that's what happened?
We are trying to investigate this lending activity. And again, what precipitated this, and certainly the lending act, or what precipitated the investigation, was lending activity that seemingly occurred prior to the tribal entity's creation.
Well, then, why don't you try to issue subpoenas against the tribes?
Well, at this point, I suppose we could start a second investigation against the tribal entities, but then we would be where we are today, because they would say we're immune. And so we're here based on...
Well, I think you're here trying to fish for an advisory opinion, perhaps, to guide your investigation. I don't understand. You know, this started with a subpoena for discovery, right?
It started with an investigative subpoena, that's correct.
Okay, against whom?
Against these lenders.
Okay, not against the tribes.
No.
So the tribes have come in to assert their and protect their immunity. But maybe they succeed here, you know, with some kind of decision that says that the issue is that the state has not properly subpoenaed them in the first place.
Well, actually, the district court has said has rejected that contention. The district court said that the tribal entities, basically all respondents, have been properly served with a subpoena. All respondents have subjected themselves to the personal jurisdiction of the court, and no parties appealed any of those findings from the district court. And the district court's, the posture that the district court put this case in is, let's go forward with contempt.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said, Mr. Chesson. What you said, the posture that
the posture that the district court put this in was, let's go forward with the contempt. Basically, both the non-tribal entities, the Nevada corporations, and the tribal entities both moved to dismiss the contempt citations. Nobody had appeared prior to the contempt citations, but they both moved to dismiss, and the district court denied their motions to dismiss, ordered the state to reschedule forthwith a contempt advisement hearing, and that was the posture that it was in, to adjudicate the merits of contempt. Did the respondents violate a court order, and did they have the ability to comply with that court order? That's the posture that the district court put this case in.
Let me ask you this. In the cases that draw this brighter line between investigation and the plenary action or the court action, has there typically been an investigation and then a decision to prosecute or a decision to enjoin or something of that sort?
I don't know, but
you're not aware of a case where we have this kind of a situation, an ongoing investigation, completely lawful, but where there has been some kind of a breakdown such that court intervention is necessary to exercise contempt?
No, I am not. I think we may be riding on a clean slate here, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chesson, could
yes.
I, before you get too far back into another thought, let me take you back a minute to your answer to Justice Martinez's question. You were starting to tell us about examples of entities that are arms of the tribe and have been upheld to be such. I don't know if we cut you off too soon, but are there examples in United States Supreme Court jurisprudence, or maybe in, even otherwise, of entities that, although created by tribal law and claimed by the tribe to be an arm of the tribe, have nevertheless been held to be not arms of the tribe and therefore not entitled to tribal immunity?
Yes. Now, I'm not aware of any U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed the arm of the tribe situation. But there are cases that we've cited. One that comes immediately to my mind is the Dixon case out of Arizona. It was a construction company that engaged in off-reservation construction. And that was held to not be entitled to immunity.
Even though the tribe was claiming immunity for it?
The company, the business, was claiming immunity mm-hmm. based on its tribe's immunity. And the Arizona Supreme Court said, no, you're not immune.
And did they, in that case, attempt to draw some line or set out some perimeters for how one decides, and how is that different from our Court of Appeals test?
Actually, several of the factors that the Court of Appeals uses did come from the Dixon case. The Dixon case did use enumerate several factors. I apologize, but I can't recall, but one of them is, did it have insurance? I think certainly one is it engaged in a governmental or proprietary function? Is it for profit or non-profit?
Things and I like guess that. The ultimate question posed by the tribes here about the 11-part test is, well, we could get down to the specifics about the parts, but it seems that what we're really arguing about is who gets to decide. Is that right? Who gets to decide whether something is an arm of the tribe?
Well, that's the courts. Ultimately, it's the courts. And why
do we think that? Why do we think that a state court would get to be the one to decide whether an entity is an arm of the tribe?
That's what state courts do, I suppose. But there's nothing to preclude a state court from doing that. The arm of the tribe analysis is a common law doctrine. And Congress has not weighed in. There's a vacuum, and Congress until such time as Congress decides to weigh in, it's up to the courts to decide that.
And when you say it's a common law doctrine, are you more agreeing with your opponent then in the way he answered my question to suggest that tribal immunity is some kind of a common law doctrine, and we can analogize it, or it is the same as sovereign immunity for states?
Oh, absolutely. I would agree that tribal sovereign immunity is a common law doctrine, and the Supreme Court has said that in the Three Affiliated Tribes case. And in fact, there in the Three Affiliated Tribes case, the Supreme Court said it's a quasi-sovereignty, that tribes are quasi-sovereigns and that their sovereignty is not congruent with that of either the federal government or the states.
And the reason I ask it, just very quickly at the end here, is it seems that in the cases you've cited to us, the Supreme Court cases, they seem to suggest that this is almost entirely a matter for Congress to decide what the scope and extent of tribal immunity will be.
Well, I think what the Supreme Court in Kiowa was saying is, look, the doctrine of tribal immunity that the U.S. Supreme Court created, that we created, me being the U.S. Supreme Court, we developed almost by accident. But it has become entrenched in our jurisprudence. So we're not going to judicially abrogate the doctrine. Congress can do that if it so chooses. But until Congress decides to choose, we will continue the doctrine, at least as respects to tribes. The only, what may fall under that umbrella of sovereign immunity, does it apply to a tribal corporation? It is being developed as we speak, and it is up to the courts to develop the full umbrella and how far-reaching the doctrine might be. And until such time as Congress speaks either to abrogate the doctrine entirely or to limit it or to apply it in certain respects, it's up to the courts to develop that area.
Thank you.
And I see my time is up, but I did want to get to Justice Coates. You did ask about individuals and whether there was any U.S. Supreme Court on individuals of tribes and or tribal officers. And in the Santa Clara case, which is cited in our briefs, there the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with a governor, the tribal governor, and whether or not he was entitled to immunity. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court basically unequivocally held that individuals are not entitled to immunity. And that was the head of the tribe that was not entitled to immunity. Thank you.
I'd like to first address opposing counsel's discussion of this Walling line of cases in an attempt to support an argument that this court should carve out an exception to tribal sovereign immunity for subpoena enforcement proceedings. It's important to note that that Walling line of cases did not involve sovereign immunity at all. It involved instances where defendants challenged the scope of the investigating agency's jurisdiction. We are not challenging the scope of the investigating agency's jurisdiction here. The state can investigate all it wants. What we are saying is that when it comes to bringing a judicial action, sovereign immunity applies. There is also a case that is directly on point, and that is the Puyallup case versus the state of Washington. And there, the United States Supreme Court upheld tribal sovereign immunity in a state court proceeding that sought to compel a tribe to produce information regarding off-reservation activity that the state claimed violated state laws. We submit that, in addition to the Kiowa Tribe of Oklahoma case, controls the outcome of this case. With regard to the discussion of the Dixon v. Picopa case that opposing counsel, Mr. Chesson, raised, that decision predated the Kiowa decision by, I believe, a decade or so, and I submit and I invite the court to examine that case because I believe that it relied upon factors that the Supreme Court in Kiowa expressly rejected, such as the purpose of the tribal organization, the location of the activity, etc. But getting back to Justice Coates' comments, the issue really is who gets to decide, and the United States Supreme Court in the Kiowa case held that states do not get to decide. The United States Supreme Court even itself said we are not in a position to decide where and whether limits on tribal sovereign immunity should be placed. Congress is better suited to make that determination. And in summary, I just ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals on the four issues that we had raised and affirm the Court of Appeals on the issues that the state raised in its cross appeal. Thank you.
Yes, the court, I want to thank all for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.